Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, Africa is being overcharged on capital and it is crippling growth. Civil society slams South Africa for a leaderless COP30. South Africa must rewrite broadband rules or be left behind in the B20 push. And cybercrime is draining 2.2 billion rand a year as governance falls behind. It's Wednesday, the 19th of November. With the G20 summit and the Global Fund meeting happening in Johannesburg this week, a hard truth, I think, is back in the spotlight. African countries are paying far more for capital than their economic fundamentals justify, and the result is billions diverted away from jobs, infrastructure, health systems, and climate resilience. Now, the One Campaign has been calling this a structural penalty that keeps the continent trapped in expensive debt and slow development. It's an important issue, and I want to discuss it with Olawuni Olabusari from the One Campaign. Olawuni, a very warm welcome to you. Why then are African governments still being charged the premium?
Thanks for having me, Jeremy. There's quite a few reasons that we see this premium on the debt that African countries have. Chief amongst it is just the perception that investing in African countries is risky. Now, while there are some fundamental risks related to currency volatility and maybe the lack of domestic capital markets that we face, some of the risk is unjustified and boils down to negative stereotypes that we see in the media and a lack of information about the real opportunity and the real return to investment that African countries also pose.
So how then, or first of all, before we talk about the how, are you able to quantify for me how much African countries are losing annually because of this this cost of capital penalty? Is there hard data available?
So Africa could be losing an estimated $74.5 billion annually due to overly subjective credit ratings, according to the UNDP. And another study by Africa Practice and Africa No Filter finds that the continent could be losing up to $4.2 billion annually in interest payments because of stereotypical narratives that dominate global media.
How do you respond to critics then who say the premium on Africa has much to do with domestic politics and policy uncertainty?
I think that that is some of the story, but it is not all of the story. There are certainly things that African governments need to do for themselves in terms of how can they have greater transparency to their fiscal situation. So what is the health of their budget? What are the things that they're taking debt out for? Are they productive investments? What are the reforms that they're putting in place that can help bolster investor confidence? So there's certainly actions for governments to take, but there are also actions for the international community to take. And that relates to things such as the rules that govern how banks see risk and so decide whether or not to invest in certain projects like clean energy projects, for example. And for that, we're going to need to see leaders in the G20 come together and start to rethink some of these what we call prudential regulations and think about which ones may be adjusted so that they're not inadvertently disincentivizing investments in African countries.
Trouble is there probably isn't appetite for that conversation right now.
I think that it depends on how we frame it, right? Investors want to see returns. And, you know, an often missed out opportunity is actually Africa's infrastructure. So we have analysis from our partners at the Hoover Institute that shows that over the last three decades, investing in core infrastructure in African countries actually delivered average returns that were six times higher than the returns on the S&P 500. So this isn't just a missed opportunity in terms of Africa's growth and African development priorities. It's a missed opportunity for institutional investors who could be seeing much higher returns in some of those projects.
So let me press you on the missed opportunity. If African risk then is genuinely mispriced, as you're suggesting, why aren't we seeing a much bigger surge of investors rushing to take advantage of the bargain that you're referring to?
I think a lot of it is information asymmetry, right? Oftentimes people don't know what opportunities are available and what returns investors stand to get. Some of what we are also calling for is about better investing in our data infrastructure and making it easier for investors to find this information, especially in a credible format. And you'll see in some of the recommendations coming out of the B20 Finance and Infrastructure Task Force that having multilateral development banks, who are some of the greatest investors in African countries, provide this information, obviously on a high level, anonymized format, but to have this more readily available and more accessible for your run-of-the-mill institutional investor.
Isn't this just a simple argument about prudent risk management? Is it fair to ask global investors to accept lower returns if some African governments continue to run large deficits, they tolerate corruption, they have weak tax systems?
I think that it's that we have to call for fairness in the global financial system. And there are plenty of countries who have higher rates of default than African countries that don't get punished in the same way on the markets. And so we have to ask ourselves, what about the financial system is creating this unfairness? And like I said before, some of it is within our control and responsibility, and we don't want to lose sight of that. But some things around improving engagements with credit rating agencies, making sure that their methodologies are transparent, and that the rules around prudential regulations don't unfairly punish African countries by doing things like not recognizing guarantees or political risk insurance and the very real instruments that people are trying to use to mitigate the risk that does exist. These are the actions that we're calling for. And I don't think that it's unreasonable to ask for the international community to support some of the innovations that we're trying to use to get around the real risks that do exist.
Let me end with this. South Africa is G20 president, but it's well known that we ourselves are grappling with debt, low growth and governance problems. One's got to ask the question, I guess, whether Pretoria really is in a credible position to lead the charge that you're calling for on behalf of the continent.
Yes, I think South Africa is in actually a much less dire situation when it comes to debt than many African countries. I think about 20 low-income countries in Africa are in or at risk of debt distress, and South Africa is not one of those. And I think that as for a long time before the African Union had a permanent seat, South Africa was the only African representation in the G20 and, you know, has a much longer track record of being a part of these negotiations. And I think what we've all really appreciated in the civil society community about South Africa's G20 leadership is that it hasn't hesitated to bring African priorities, even on issues that maybe don't affect it to the extent that it does some other African countries, into the limelight, into the spotlight, and really make those issues priorities for its presidency. So I know that it's been a difficult G20 with all of the geopolitical headwinds, but I do believe the South African government has tried its best to navigate those while keeping the needs of the continent at the center.
Thank you very much indeed, Olawuni Olabosari from the One Campaign. I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, civil society seems to be turning up the heat on the presidency with COP30 in full swing and the G20 summit just days away now. Environmental groups say South Africa has created, and I quote, a dangerous leadership vacuum by recalling the Minister Dion George in the middle of global climate negotiations. They warn this could weaken our negotiating power, jeopardize billions in potential climate finance, and damage our standing as a leading African climate voice. Well, joining us now from the Green Connection is Advocacy Officer Lisa Makaula, who says the timing sends the wrong signal at the worst possible moment. Lisa, a very warm welcome to you. What evidence do you have that South Africa's absence at ministerial level is weakening our negotiating position?
I mean, for now, we are just looking from like a monitoring perspective, because if you recall, South Africa recently published its NDCs, which we then took to the UNFCCC COP30. And when we look at those NDCs, you know, there's basically a discussion that South Africa as a country needs about 260 billion in investment. And that is from 2026 until 2035. So, I mean, not having a ministerial representation at this important platform then starts to create, you know, some sort of a narrative. So we are kind of a bit worried in terms of what it would mean in terms of South Africa's commitments as well as our standing at this global platform.
Are you not overstating it slightly when you're suggesting it signals a lack of commitment? Why do you say that?
I mean, we are not necessarily saying that it is signaling lack of commitment, but because we are a country that, you know, is already on a path of transitioning, and we have this just energy transition investment plans in place, and for us not being presently available from a ministerial level at these negotiations, we are a bit worried that it could, you know, signal that we are not taking this debate quite very importantly, because South Africa still needs to raise quite a lot of money, particularly for adaptation. And I think from a climate change perspective, we have seen how communities, particularly in South Africa, have been affected by this. And this is for the communities in the Eastern Cape as well as KZN. So, I mean, we do need investments in adaptation to make sure that our communities and cities are resilient.
I want to come back to that commitment, though. South Africa has career negotiators and technical teams at COP. Are they not enough?
I mean, it's so important to have a minister, you know, present at these tables, because, you know, I think South Africa especially, we have you know, been quite leading when it comes to discussions about climate finance. And also with these current NDCs that have recently been tabled to portray the amount of investments that South Africa actually needs to build this resilience, particularly in adaptation and mitigation. So, I mean, the presence of the minister at this particular global platform, we still believe it remains very important and critical.
Are there specific opportunities or decisions then at COP30 that you believe South Africa is now missing or weakening as a result of this decision?
Firstly, it is the discussions around adaptation, as mentioned earlier before, that with the current decisions are basically, I mean, discussions there on climate finance. And for the country to be able to create resilient communities as well as to adapt, we need this climate finance. And if you look at the NDCs, you will see that the amount that is needed on investments, particularly in climate finance, is about 250 billion from 2026 and until 2035. So that is money that is currently required for adaptation measures. So it still remains important that, you know, we do have some ministerial representation at these platforms so that our positions could be echoed, but also at the same time, to be able to get this finance, to be able to rebuild our infrastructure so that it's able to withstand the climate economic shock.
I understand the point that you're making, but is it really fair to assume that our diplomatic partners view this as instability, as you're suggesting? Might they not just see this as a routine political reshuffle?
I mean, at the moment, I don't think the South African delegation and it not having like some sort of a minister, it's to say that the technical teams have not really done the work, because as I've mentioned, the NDCs have already been published. But what still remains important is to have someone on the ground who's able to actually echo those voices and make sure that we are involved in those negotiating rooms.
How credible is your argument as well that this, if I've read it correctly, harms our G20 positioning, given, Lisa, that climate is only one part of a very big agenda?
I mean, within the G20, leading up to the current summit, there has been sad events. And within those sad events, we've been involved in definitely providing some recommendations on some of the positions and technical reports. But we still do believe that once the declaration has been put forward, it would still remain important, you know, for South Africa to make sure that we have a clear position in terms of how we would be addressing climate issues. Because I think when we speak about climate change, you can't see it as a separate issue. It affects economy. It affects the communities, which later means that the budget that has been put forward, you know, for the country, it now needs to be reprioritized to look into addressing issues of the climate crisis in a case whereby there is an emergency. So we still say that it remains important that these debates are on the table and are taken into consideration when the adoption of the declaration is being made.
And just a final question. You've publicly escalated a very important issue. I'm assuming that an organization like yours would also be engaging directly with Treasury and the presidency to understand the rationale. What have they told you?
I mean, we have actually submitted an open letter to the president raising these concerns. And so far, we have not received acknowledgement, particularly on our issues and concerns around the COP30 and not having a ministerial representation at the summit. So we are still hoping that, you know, we would be able to engage with these officials, because this remains an important factor, especially for the affected community.
Thank you very much indeed, Lisa Makaula from the Green Connection. I do appreciate your time today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
As the B20 summit gets underway today, one of the big ticket items is digital inclusion, with a bold target to connect 1 billion people by 2030. But South Africa has a problem. According to Elita Telecom's Chief Executive Officer and Startup 20 Chair, Vuyani Dahana, we're still measuring the wrong thing. He says access means nothing if people can't meaningfully use broadband, and that our current business models simply don't work in townships and rural areas. He argues that without re-engineering so-called last-mile economics, South Africa is going to miss both its digital inclusion goals and the jobs opportunity that comes with them. Vuyani, a very warm welcome. You say that South Africa needs to replace access with meaningful connectivity. What does meaningful connectivity actually mean?
Yeah, thank you. Thanks very much, Arani. I think meaningful connectivity, we refer to it as both access and affordability. So you can have access, but if you cannot afford it, then it's not meaningful. Secondly, access with the right level of bandwidth, so where you can actually do real work. So capacity to execute on the digital side, but also affordability. It's presence, bandwidth capacity, as well as affordability. Those three elements are critical ingredients of meaningful connectivity. And that's what we argue, that mostly in township and rural areas, you at some point you have access, but it's not meaningful because the bandwidth is very low. At the same time, the cost to access it are quite astronomically high that households cannot afford.
Operators, of course, will say to you that they have extensive coverage. Your argument would be that that might not be the case, and that the key issue here is affordability.
Correct. It's affordability, but also just the bandwidth. You remember, South Africans will always remember that a lot of what is in the township and rural areas is a mobile broadband. Mobile broadband, by its very nature, has got limitations because it's a contented service. So we need to be able to build a stronger capability, fixed infrastructure, both optic fiber and fixed wireless access, to actually make sure that people can actually work from home, can actually be at school sitting at home. Today, the bandwidth currently is not able to carry the demands of internet. More so, the affordability is another constraint. Mm. And that's what we think we need: a new model, new business model, a new commercial model to drive accessibility, affordability, but still commercially sound for investment.
I can't help but wonder if you're not fighting a losing battle. Traditional operators might see last-mile township markets simply as low margin. What makes you confident that a redesigned model would succeed where they have failed?
I think, to be honest with you, our argument is that it's not even about the large scale operators being dragged into that market. It's about government working in partnership with the private sector to expand the network capillarity into those areas, into rural clusters, into townships, so that smaller operators, ISPs that could be youth and women owned in village clusters, can be able to provide this service cost effectively. They will have lower overheads, but what you need is a network capillarity. Internet point of presence is not available in many rural clusters. Yet we think that we want to digitize the economy, but also we think about the future of education as digital. I do not believe that South Africa should be building brick and mortar university into the future. Actually, it should be looking at digitizing the current university to drive access. If you do so, then without investing in broadband infrastructure into the length and breadth of the country, you're always going to come short. You're going to drive inequality, and you're not going to be inclusive or even on education.
Do you think
it's possible?
Do you think digital inclusion should even sit in the telecoms domain? Maybe it requires something bigger, like a national industrial strategy that goes just beyond the data pipes that you're talking about.
No, certainly so. It's a cross-sectoral intervention. We are the different engagement group of the G20. Across all of them, the digitization is at the center of everything. And you would sit and think that this is universal access for all. So I think a large-scale program that is going to expand infrastructure into the length and breadth of the country to enable SMEs, students, families to actually participate in the digital ecosystem is critical. From a policy point of view, the communications department can lead this, but from an investment point of view, it has to be a country intervention that is critical for the future. If in my own analysis, the areas like education, they cost a lot of money to the fiscals, healthcare, and the policing. But all those things can have a very good intervention to digital platforms that can actually, the incremental cost of putting one student into a university could be very, very low if we digitize them. But you can't digitize if you don't invest in the underlying infrastructure, which is what we feel should happen. And I agree, it should be more of a national intervention, more than just a department, because it's cross-sectional.
Why do you think no one's listening to your argument?
So I think people are listening to the argument. I just think that the modeling, not everyone has gone through how to model. I think everyone is relying on individual private sector investment instead of a joint approach between government and public sector and private sector, but also thinking more about how, if you invest in this way, large infrastructure rollout, you could actually enable entrepreneurship and create the much needed jobs using the digital ecosystem. So I think it takes time for these things to germinate. I think we are getting closer to everyone understanding that unless we invest at scale, we are going to leave people behind and we're going to drive inequality. There will be a new form of inequality where young people born in democracy may be differently endowed in terms of opportunity at the back of digital divide.
If you're pushing for the partnership model, surely they'll turn around and say there is limited return on investment here.
No, there's certainly a good return on investment. I'll make the case, for example, if you look at the case of the Eastern Cape, the Eastern Cape government has undertaken to connect all its public institutions, schools, clinics across the length and breadth of the province. They've asked for a 1 gig fiber service upgradable to 10 gigabytes per second. Now, when this thing is done, it brings internet closer to the villages to serve government, but also communities can leverage this through small private sector companies taking advantage of existing network capillarity built at the back of government demand. So it's not about just investing and hoping that there will be a service. It's to meet government demand. In that process, you're able to get that infrastructure leveraged by small players in those communities, in those townships, to actually deliver the much-needed service to digitize the economy and enable more and more people to participate in the digital ecosystem.
Well, it'll be very interesting to see how this debate plays out, particularly over the next couple of days. Vuyani Dekgana, thank you very much indeed, Chair of Startup 20.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, Africa's digital revolution has outpaced its defenses, it seems. A new report from Checkpoint Software Technologies, it's due for release this week, shows cybercrime is costing South Africa something in the region of 2.5 billion rand a year. And attacks are no longer the exception, but a structural feature of digital life. And with artificial intelligence supercharging both attackers and defenders, and governments rushing ahead with digital IDs and e-services, cyber risk, I think, is becoming a real drag on growth, trust, and trade. So let's interrogate that report in a little more detail. From Checkpoint, Ian Janse van Rensburg, a very warm welcome to you. Why do you think digital growth on the continent has dramatically outpaced its cyber governance? Who's responsible for closing that gap?
So great question there. You know, the fact is digital growth is tremendous in the Africa continent, in contrary to what people might think in the world. And it's all about delivering the services that people need from an African perspective. As an example, in Kenya, the M-Pesa payment system that they have, it's really, really good way of on transacting with money and paying shops and so forth. So it's the need of the people in Africa that's driving this digital transformation, but it's growing at such a rate to fill those people's needs that security is actually being left behind and not thought of. It's almost like an afterthought. And hackers are definitely extorting that environment.
Do you think that if cyber attacks are now structural, as you're suggesting, it's a sign that governments have now just normalized failure rather than improving resilience?
Look, the fact is normalizing failure, I wouldn't really call it in normalizing failure. What we're seeing within in companies in Africa is they are really trying very, very hard to fill the gaps. Even though we're saying that digital transformation is outpacing the security resilience, it's a fact, but it's not to say that companies in Africa is not pushing very, very hard to fill those gaps. From a Checkpoint perspective, we are seeing an increase in spend from a security perspective in Africa. And for the first time in years, Latin America has actually surpassed Africa from a hacking perspective because Africa is really becoming more resilient towards cybersecurity.
Ian, you talk about investment in the problem, but there's also the argument, I guess, that many in the private sector have underinvested in basic, what do you call it, cyber hygiene while still chasing growth, and they're paying the consequences for that.
Correct. You know, it all comes down to money at the end of the day. Life is almost these days driven by money and the net profit that companies need to make. And to secure an environment, an IT environment with NIST2 network internet systems security, it costs a lot of money. And the budgets that needs to be allocated for the security is sometimes limited and underestimated. A company, once you are hit by ransomware or a cybersecurity attack, number one, it's too late. Your brand might have been already damaged and your customer trust might have already been damaged. So it's really underrated and it's actually almost, you can call it priceless in investing in good cybersecurity. It's like having insurance for your car. You know, you pay a big premium on a monthly basis and you might not be in an accident. It's the same with companies. But I do agree that more budget, more money can be spent on securing companies.
The figure that really leaps out, obviously, is South Africa losing 2.2 billion rand a year to cybercrime. But I'd suggest to you the real issue here is that almost none of those losses have resulted in prosecutions, and that's a problem.
Very true. It becomes very complex. If a company is hit by a cyber attack, which is the majority of it's the major share of incidents is ransomware. I mean, Africa gets hit by ransomware 41% of the time on a yearly basis. And most of the companies that's hit by a cyber attack is related or linked to ransomware. Now, once the ransomware is detected, cyber companies come in and security companies come in to identify who the cyber attackers are. They can then negotiate with these, believe it or not, they negotiate with these attackers from a money perspective. And sometimes those negotiations go well, sometimes it does not go well. But the authorities, like the police, we do involve them. But these cyber criminals is such a big team of people, and they are so well hidden that they really actually get prosecuted, as you say.
And if that's the case, then we are seeing digital IDs and e-government rollouts, which are obviously, Ian, raising exposure. Is there an argument that these programs should be slowed until cyber capacity catches up?
I would say not slowed. You know, will cyber capacity ever catch up? On the dark web, there is millions of new exploits, or what we call day zero vulnerabilities, that's being released on a daily basis. So will cyber resilience ever catch up? I hope so. I really do hope so. We are trying our best from a Checkpoint perspective with our what we call our threat AI cloud, which monitors over 86 billion threats on a daily basis. And we are trying our best through AI engines, looking at the dark web and every single possible area that we can look at to catch up. But I don't think that the digital space should slow down so that security can catch up. It's basically it needs to move forward. Otherwise, we won't show any innovation moving forward in this world.
Yeah, and I mean, innovation obviously leads to competitiveness and profitability. Nonetheless, it's a very disturbing report, and right on the button, I guess. That figure of 2.2 billion rand a year really does cause one's eyebrows to raise. Ian Janse van Rensburg from Checkpoint, thank you very much indeed. Appreciate your time. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.